Hello, everyone, and as if you can't tell already, I haven't shaved since the season one finale, but thankfully this is the season two premiere, and we're very excited to kick off another amazing season of the Cybersecurity Matters podcast. And joining me, as always, is the amazing and sometimes coherent Mr. Christian Redshaw. Christian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Hopefully I can put a few words together for you.
Who are we kicking off season one with?
So, Dominic, we have Vanessa Henri from a law firm called Faskin. And I'm so excited to have her on the show today. We've spoken over LinkedIn and I see her posts. She's such a wonderful, humble, but intelligent lady. And I can't wait to hear what she has to say to us today.
Oh, yeah. I can't think of a better guest to kick off season two. So Christian and I are going to keep the energy levels high. And we're going to bring Vanessa in virtually, of course. And stay tuned. We'll be right back with her.
Well, hello, Vanessa. It's such an honor to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So there are so many questions that we have for you today, and the first one is really about you. So can you tell us how you got involved in cybersecurity and privacy and law and what it is about your career that you love?
Right, about that weird expertise between law and cybersecurity and how that happens. I finished my bachelor, I was fairly young, I was 22 years old, and because in Quebec you can finish quite fast. And I thought, I wanted to go into criminal law, that was my first thought, and I thought, wow, I'm way too young, who's going to hire this little blonde girl? So I went into doing a master. And back in the days was when WikiLeaks was very popular, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange. And it slowly went from studying criminality to crimes against the state, espionage, cyber espionage, and then kind of went all the way into privacy and cybersecurity over time. I got very lucky to work in a cybersecurity firm as my first job. My first contract I worked was a managed security services agreement. So I don't think that's standard. Yeah, and today I work also with small and medium enterprise in particular. I like to work with startups and work with emerging technology like AI and see how we can make that kind of secure and private by design in accordance with the law.
That's perfect. Well, you touched on so many things and there are some threads that we're going to pull on there, especially focused right now on small and medium-sized organizations, because that's perfect for the discussion today. Can you take us to school and can you really, in very basic terms, talk about the difference between privacy and cybersecurity? We always say it's two sides of the same coin or brother, sister, or close cousins. How would you break that down?
Right. And it's a very good question. I would say one of the important distinction between information security in particular and personal information security is how you will assess the risk. So when you look at cybersecurity as a business, you care about you. How much is it going to cost me? What are the operational impact? What are the reputational impact? But when you're doing a privacy risk assessment, it's all about the consumer, the people who are using your product. If there's a data breach, are these people going to feel stressed? Maybe they're going to be the victim of discrimination. Maybe they'll lose their job. They'll be embarrassed. And these kind of these attributes of severity are not necessarily taken into consideration when you do information security. So there are distinctions. Obviously, privacy is a human right. It is grounded in the law, whereas information security, at least in Canada, there's no extensive legislation about this. However, there are extensive legislation about how you're supposed to secure personal information, and that's where the overlap is. That's why you have standard like ISO 27701 that take a standard that is ISO 27001, a security standard, and they create kind of this extension on privacy, which will apply to a subset of the information that you're trying to protect. Confidential information is not personal information. So let's say your source code and the likes are not protected by law. You have to protect that by contract. So there's overlap, but one doesn't always equal the other one.
So a question just following up on that, and I will let Dominic ask you a question eventually. Is there a threshold? Can you comment on when you need to report a privacy breach? Like, what's the minimum standard required to trigger that?
Right. So at the moment, there's only the federal legislation that requires a mandatory notification along with certain cases in Alberta. So it's not a Canada-wide thing yet, although not doing it may engage your liability because there's going to be more damages for the consumer. So either way, you should do it. Just want to make sure my message doesn't go across the wrong way. But the threshold that you'll see on the pipetta is that there has to be real and significant risk to individuals. So you'll need to look at severity. You'll need to look at likelihood. So you do perform that assessment and you try to determine what are the risks for individuals. If for example, if the information was taken by a hacker, there may be a higher risk of misuse. Whereas if it was taken or disclosed by mistake to a partner and you can call them back and say, can you please delete this right away? And they say, yes, I've deleted it. Then the risk will be significantly lower. So you have to consider a lot of things in terms of context. And you also have to be sensitive that in case of doubt, the best approach is probably to think there's a risk because you want to notify as much as possible the data subjects, the individuals whose personal information has been breached, especially so if you're talking about credit card information, social security number. These individuals, the sooner they're notified, the sooner they can call their credit card and have this block so that you don't have to pay for extra damages, right? So you want to make sure that you take everything into consideration. In many cases, you'll have to notify the authorities if you meet that threshold, and you'll have to justify how you made that risk assessment. You'll have to say that these are the reason why I think we should notify. And that's going to be under the scrutiny of the authority. So you want to make sure that you're 100% honest. You want to make sure that you understand what's happening. It's important to show that you have an understanding of the severity and that you're willing to act accordingly.
And that's so insightful. I mean, for our small mid-sized business audience, and at least the first question I want to ask you again is on that privacy side. You mentioned the privacy legislation in Canada. When you compare the privacy legislation in Canada compared to, let's say, the what's at least often referred to as the gold standard, being the GDPR in the EU. Where is Canada on that privacy legislation? Is there still significant room for improvement in terms of matching with the GDPR? Are we going to be seeing greater privacy legislation in the coming years?
Yeah, I think the starting point to understand is our legislation in Canada, and if you look at Australia, New Zealand, it's based on the 10 Fair Information Principle. So these were, I think they became popular about the time when databases came out. Mm. So when you look at the collection, the use, and the disclosure, what they had in mind is that big pool of data and data's coming in and out of them. What GDPR does that our laws don't do is that they look at it very differently. Obviously, they have the benefits of 25 years later. Right. And it looks at the design too. So our laws do not say, for example, you can make a technology that's completely intrusive, but you're not using it. Your clients are using it. So they bear the weight of making sure that what they do with it, once they install it into their system, is going to meet the threshold. So one of the big distinction I would say between Canada and the EU is that as it is today, we don't necessarily do a super good job of regulating the design of technology. So it's a very different approach. And that's also why consent is so important to us, whereas in the EU, it's just one of the things that you can look at. For example, they can rely on the performance of a contract, which makes sense if your supplier is bound by privacy by design. Whereas if it's not the case, then consent also makes sense. So it's difficult to change one section and not create a domino effect. It's difficult to take things from the EU and just import them and think they're going to work like that. There are a lot of laws that are working together. Think about the Canadian anti-spam law legislation that is working on implicit consent for cookies. And it may be kind of the jurisdiction of the CRTC to look at this and they work with the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. So there is a willingness to change it, but it's not as easy as it looks. It's not just like, oh, we're going to add this, this, and this, and it's going to make this very nice patchwork and just kind of we vote on this and it's good. The last time we tried to change PIPEDA, which is the federal law, there was significant lobbyism around not changing it. For example, it may affect our journalist works. So there's many, many things to consider at the federal level. But we are seeing a lot more movement at the provincial level, which is interesting because I think the Office of the Privacy Commissioner is the first one who came forward and said, we want to change the law. But we still don't have a draft, whereas Quebec has already published its Bill 64 draft. Right. The adoption of the principle is underway. Some people think that it may occur during the month of October. And maybe we'll have a law that's going to be in effect pretty fast, given the substantial changes that are in that law. And that law will be much closer to GDPR. The first thing that's going to be much closer is the fines. So up to 4% of your annual turnover, $25 million. And now we have Ontario that just wants to follow suit. They've announced they'll make their own law. They currently do not have any, which means that the federal law applies by default. So they're going to go to market with their own law. It'll be interesting to see how these laws will harmonize for companies across Canada as well.
Learning so much just in these few minutes we've just been chatting here.
It definitely provokes a thought for me. So as a Canadian, Vanessa, how do you view the state of affairs in terms of the privacy side of things in the United States versus GDPR versus Canada? For example, the California privacy laws. And like, how do you see the state now and where do you see things going in America?
I think there's a wide perception that the States is just very bad at privacy. People are just saying that all the time. It's not entirely true. Like, Illinois has the first biometric law in the world, if I recall correctly. And HIPAA, which is the health legislation at the federal level, is not from yesterday. It's quite an old law, and it's very advanced for the age it has. It's not true that the U.S. does not have a good privacy. Is they have a patchwork of privacy, and second, they also have very specific privacy. So they started to look at the most sensitive information one by one. What they don't have is a general privacy legislation, and because marketing tends to fall under this, it has allowed an ad tech business to develop quite extensively in the United States, which has led people to think that they don't have privacy. So the CCPA, the California Consumer Protection Act, kind of tackles that very directly, especially so given that it's a Californian law and we know who's located there. The issue, I think, with CCPA for people, at least seen from the outside, is that the law is not simple. It is very different from GDPR on many points, different from other laws. So it comes up with its own model, which means that corporations, again, have another model to comply with. So you have Canada, now you have the EU, now you have the CCPA, and it's very precise. For example, your button that says, do not sell my personal information has to be that big in that corner. So there are concerns that what if 52 states do that? How many buttons do I need on my website, right?
That's a lot of buttons.
They need a federal button. It's just a little idea
That's
for the suggestion box.
That's what they're trying to do, right?
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to do. But the issue at the federal level is people cannot agree on whether individuals should have a right to sue or not. Right. Because if you give individual the right to sue, you just open the door to privacy class action lawsuits. So significant lobbyism around this. Even attorneys general, many of them do not want to have the exclusive responsibility for suing. So we do not have staff for this. But many states just want to keep it with the attorney generals. So there, I think everybody in the U.S. Seems to agree that they need to have a more general privacy approach that's going to tackle marketing federal on a federal level. But there are many concerns in terms of the impact that these laws would have on business, especially now in the middle of a somewhat economic crisis we can think of. And everybody trying to go online at the moment, do we want to add to that for small businesses? So many, many concerns. One thing that the U.S. does that we don't do is a threshold. So in the U.S., in California, there's a significant threshold. It's 50,000 users or $25 million there, or you have to sell half of your data. We don't do none of that in Canada. So the new the new Bill 64 would apply the same, whether you're a restaurant or you're a telecom company.
Gotcha. And you know, I want to go back to a comment you mentioned earlier about privacy by design and by extension, security by design. How important is that concept? Again, I mean, at its root, just talking about baking in security and privacy from the beginning, not like how we've traditionally been doing it by bolting it on after the fact. And that's just not very effective. So for startups and for organizations that are just starting out, how important is that they bake in security and privacy processes from the beginning, and how do they go about doing so?
Yeah, I think the importance is not legal. It is it's first business, obviously moral and ethical, but it's business too. For example, if you're an insurtech, you want to sell to insurance companies. Insurance companies know that they have to be very strict on how they comply with the legislation. They're very big and they're very likely to get sued for a mistake. Mm-hmm. So they'll push back on their supplier and they'll ask you to do so many things that if you don't do your product that is privacy by design, you'll have a lot of trouble to actually find clients. So in many cases, it is driven by the industry, like in insurance, in the medical software as a device. There are many, many requirements there that are very compelling for companies to do it. And my experience with startup is that they're doing it. They're happy to do it. They come forward, they ask questions, they want to know the best way to do it. I don't feel resistance. I don't know if people have that feeling that the tech companies are working against them, but my experience with startup is that it's not the case. They're very open to do it differently. And because they're younger, they have the chance to do it. Trying to turn around the Titanic is much harder. So we have to also understand that when you're asking a very big business to do privacy by design after 40 years of having issued products is not the same thing. So I have a lot of hope that the next generation of tech company will have understood that. Mm-hmm. And many of them are going further. They're going what I call ethic by design. They want to make sure there's no environmental impact. They want to make sure that it's secure. They want to make sure that it doesn't discriminate, that it's fair, that it's lawful. So all of these concerns seem to be there for startup, and it's important to make money. Now, there are industries that do not have these giant pushing down requirements. Marketing is one of them, and they depend on consumer pushing up the requirements. Right. So there may be more things that we're going to see in consumer protection law over time, but these industries tend to have less incentive to do it unless there's a law that comes in. And that's why the laws still remain important. Now, I'm not saying that each ad tech or mark tech are by default trying to not do that. Many are trying to adjust, but they also have competitors that are not doing it. There are competitors that are just doing whatever they want, and these startups are trying to get shares of the market. So these decisions are very hard for them, and there's investors behind them that are pushing too. So these type of areas is where we need to work more with legislation to make sure that it remains important where there's no other incentive to do it.
Vanessa, I want to bring the conversation back to cybersecurity and privacy together and how they work with each other. I'm sure that it's case by case and industry by industry, but do you recommend to do one first and then the other? What are the factors that go in terms of you advising a company on whether they should do privacy or security first, or just tackling them maybe in parallel?
So if you have a product that, let's say, is a IoT for consumer or anything that's directed to consumer, there's no reason to do it separately because you will likely have a lot of personal information. Right. So it's generally the privacy impact assessment that you have to do should cover security. The reason why we still see that being done separately is not a legal reason. It's not a functional reason. It's an expertise reason. Mm. Most people don't know how to do both. So you have to go to two different suppliers. Yeah. My preference is always to work with somebody in cybersecurity that can actually open the car and check, like, what are you telling me? Is it true? Is it not true? What kind of encryption you're looking at? And somebody that can actually verify that it's done, because not everybody has the expertise to actually tell you what is in the product that they're using. It may be a off-the-shelf product as well. So in these cases, they should come together. And whenever possible, the best way to do it is to have a privacy expert and have a security expert work end in end, keeping in mind that privacy laws are laws. So people have to be careful about not giving legal advice. This is a reserved act because there are so many concerns. There's so many things that may not be obvious at the reading of the laws. There's so many ways it has been interpreted that it's very dangerous to tell a client your consent's not appropriate when you don't know if maybe there are exceptions, maybe there is an implicit consent. So you really want to have an interdisciplinary team looking at it, both when you do the risk assessment and both when you manage privacy in your organization. But if you're looking at, for example, determining if your system is secure to have your trade secret in it, then there's no reason to do a privacy impact assessment whatsoever. Or if you have two different systems that are very isolated, you may decide to do it differently. So in these cases, it's an operational and functional decision based on what you have in the system that you're trying to assess the risk.
Vanessa, this has just been an absolutely amazing conversation. I mean, there's just been so much good stuff to learn. If our viewers want to reach out to you to learn more about privacy or how to renovate your office, how can people reach out? How can people best reach out to you?
Well, they can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I tend to respond as much as I can, and I share as much information as I can. I do also a lot of pro bono awareness training, especially this month is the October awareness training as we're recording this. I try also to reach out, like if you're a teacher, if you're working with people that are vulnerable and do not have access to information security expertise or privacy expertise, don't be shy to reach out. It just takes 15 minutes to talk to kids and explain them to be safe. So we're always happy to do this, and we're always happy to answer any questions.
That's amazing, Vanessa. Thank you for everything that you do. I know we've been connected for a long time on LinkedIn, and we're both very grateful to have you on the show.
It's
Vanessa,
my pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your wisdom.
It's really
with
my
us.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was an all-star way of kicking off season two. I mean, that was hashtag legendary. Vanessa is scary smart. You know, just so much of what she was talking about, security and privacy, stuff I thought I knew. I mean, she just schooled us in a good way. You know, she is such a good teacher at heart, and you learn so much from her. And you know, before I give my takeaway, I'd like to know what sort of your key takeaway was from the many lessons that she shared with us.
I had a very parallel experience of that, and as soon as we ended the conversation, I remember giving her a big hand clap. So I completely agree. I loved not only that she took us through the differences between privacy and cybersecurity and also how they interplay together, but also kind of the global picture on the different frameworks and standards for privacy, from GDPR to PIPEDA in Canada to sort of the patchwork of developing privacy legislation in the United States as well. Very, very insightful.
You know, again, she's just so full of useful and practical information, you know, and at times I forget that she's a lawyer. You know, she's just so pleasant as well. And
a lawyer and she's nice.
Yeah, and she's nice. Yeah, a rarity in terms of a combination there. And when she was talking about, you know, that concept of privacy by design and security by design, and you know, how that morphs in different shapes and sizes for organizations, from startup to SMB to when they're an enterprise, and talking about how hope for organizations of tomorrow that they're going to be abiding by these principles from the beginning. You know, so it's very, very interesting and very insightful. And like you and I were saying, Christian, honestly, what an awesome way to kick off season two.
Completely agree.
And to our loyal listeners and viewers, thank you for obviously joining us for season two. We're super excited for all the incredible guests that we're going to be bringing you over the course of the next, year or so, and for joining us on a weekly basis. You know, we're very much striving to provide that same type of engagement and entertainment and just downright really interesting guests, hopefully on that weekly basis. Please do stay with us on a weekly basis. We appreciate your loyalty so much. And for any previous episodes that you want to check on or from season one, please do make sure to check out the Conversations That Matter YouTube page, as well as there's a slew of other awesome podcasts that appear under the Conversations That Matter banner. But until next week, be well, be awesome, and thank you again for joining us on the Cybersecurity Matters podcast.
We'll see you next week.